Today my guests are Zella Cogswell and Ike Carson, and their parents were Samuel and Ida Carson. And I think Zella's going to be first. Would you like to tell us something about your family when you first came to Fort Fairfield?
I, with my parents, came to Fort Fairfield from Maplewood, NB, in 1897. I was then 6 years old. The first place we stopped was at...
That was Acorns.
Acorns in Maple Grove, where we stayed overnight. Then we went to live on the Thurlow farm, where Dad ran the farm for Fred Thurlow. From there, we moved to an apartment over Skate's drugstore, and Dad went to work in the starch factory across the river until it burned in 1900. Then Dad bought the Wellington House, the first frame house built in Fort Fairfield, which we later sold to the government as they planned to build a U.S. Customs house on the lot.
Now this house, this was the first frame house, and this was built by Fitzherbert, and it was a tavern during the Rustic War. This is the same house.
Yes, it is.
And could you tell us a little that you remember about the house?
Well, there's one thing I remember distinctly, as every time we went down cellar, they had it stored an old cannon in there. We didn't know where it came from, but it always frightened the life out of me every time I went down and looked at it. And finally, one night, somebody came and stole the cannon. We didn't know where it ever went to.
But this is the same cannon.
This is the same cannon.
Mm-hmm. That's on the library lawn.
That's on the library lawn now.
Mm-hmm. And what about the doorbell on the house?
Well, it was a unique doorbell. It there was a knob on the outside of the door that was silver colored, kind of glistened in the sun. You pulled that knob and it pulled a wire from the inside. This wire was strung in every room in the house. Being an old tavern, I suppose they had bells all on these wires, and when you pulled it, it rang the bells in all the rooms.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ike, you were born in this house. You probably remember something about the house and something about the settlement around the town.
Yeah. I can remember that. You know, I was born in 1902 there in this house, and I recall when I was young, you know, when I was a young fellow, that the ceilings were terrible low. You could reach right up, really, it hit, and they were so low. You come out of the down steps into the kitchen, and that is another little part. A long, long building, and then out the woodshed. But in the old day, I can remember going down the hill. But parents, they used to kind of have to time me. I used to like to wander around like I do now, I guess. But anyway, I go down, and before you cross the bridge, there's a building there. And there, on the left-hand side, before the old road, which is around between the starch factory, old starch factory, and Jack Dunahee's house now, used to go there. And there used to be some work... woodworking shops there, wagon shops where they built the wagons, and the blacksmith shop on the other side. The old watering trough was on the left-hand side as you crossed the bridge. And then the store, which then Del Edwards had, and he handled most everything that you could. As you went out the Dorsey Road, on the right, there was a grist mill, which was powered by a water wheel from the old dam down there. And then just beyond that, there was a stave mill where they cut out stave for the barrels, wooden barrels, bitter barrels. And across the road was a barrel factory, a little shop where they used to make barrels. And the old jail stood over there. And across on the other side of the brook was the Haynes, Del Haynes. Will Haynes owned had a lumber mill, and that also was powered by a water wheel in the dam there. And then on the outside of that, there was a shingle mill. He also had a shingle mill there, and that, of course, the bridge was quite close to that then, the old river bridge.
You must remember a livery stable.
Yes. It was up now. There's the Burns livery stable used to set about where Ossie's store was, which also served as a custom office. Burns was a custom officer then. That's where Ossie's store is now. And that was close by to then the old Collins House Hotel was next to that. Dorsey's had another livery stable down to lower end street near the CP station on the right hand side of the road. And well, there's a lot of stores used to be in there then. I can remember Abadou Abraham and Bill Aob used to have a store then in the lower end. And later years there used to be a customs office there too, before it went to the line.
Well, Zella, do you remember the covered bridge?
Yes, I remember the covered bridge very well. I know there's big cracks in it.
Those big cracks. It was where the iron...
Where the old iron bridge was before this new one was built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, do you remember a circus coming to town when you were a boy?
Oh, yes. I can remember when I was just a young fellow. Of course, then they had down the trotting park. All the fairs like this would be down there in the where they exercise horses now. They had a big park there and a ball diamond and a grandstand. And they'd come in the night with a train, on a train. And we'd go up to the B&A station and go 2-3 o'clock when they'd arrive and watch them unload the wagons. And then they'd hook these 4 or 6 horse teams on them and haul them down to the park and erect the tents and then that part of the train, and then a little later they would come back and bring the animals down. Then us young folks would get a little job helping set up the tents, and we'd get a pass into the shows. They'd give us a pass in to see the circus, and then around noontime they'd have the horses and the animals, they'd have the street parade, would parade up through the town and back again before the main show. They had the little side shows, you know, with all the midgets and stuff in there, and then we'd go into the main show, and it was quite an oddity.
My guest is Marion French, and she's going to tell us a story about one of her ancestors. This is a story of Warren Johnson, who would be a great uncle of mine, and who took part in the Rustic War when he was a young boy. He would be an uncle of my mother's, and his father, William Johnson, was one of the early settlers of Fort Fairfield. This story is taken from his obituary that ran in the Bangor Commercial at the time he died, back in 1907, when he was 84 years old. It says that as very few of the early pioneers remained to tell their rough experiences in the wilderness country of Arusta in the years of 38 to 40, we are requested to repeat this story of his early adventures, which associates with its history of interest. In the winter of 1838 and 9, after the first detachment of drafted state militia had reached Masadas, movement was made down the Arusta River on the ice. There were in all 50 or 60 double sleds loaded with men. The ice was in good condition, and the sight of so many men and teams filled the hearts of a few inhabitants along the river banks with consternation and foreboding. All along the trip, the fearless soldiers watched carefully for signs of the provincial invaders. At last, when near the mouth of the Presque Isle stream, two teams with men emerged from the woods and were on the ice before they discovered that the Yankees were close upon them. A lively race ensued. Down the river, the horses were urged at the top of their speed until they reached what was known as the Reach Road. This was a short cut through the woods leading down by what is now Fort Fairfield Village to the boundary. The invaders sought refuge by leaving the ice and taking this woods road.
Great was their chagrin when they found that their horses were so weary that they could not be urged beyond a walk on the long uphill grades and on the level of crooks and turns. Roots and snags prevented their going fast if they had been in good condition. The Yankees took advantage of this situation. Leaping from their sleds, they ran on in advance of their teams and soon captured the trespassers and returned to the reach at a point nearly opposite the place then owned by William Johnston and since known as the Weeks Place. Here, a part of the men stopped on their way down and were preparing a camp. This was the camping ground of the militia for several days. While there, land agent Rufus McIntyre, Major Strickland, and Captain Stover Rhines drove down toward the boundary to reconnoiter, with a view to establishing a headquarters or fort. They drove on until they reached the mouth of Patee Brook, then known as the Fitzherbert Brook, named for James Fitzherbert, who lived there, did all the blacksmithing there was to be done, and furnished the occasional traveler with food and lodging. Here the officers felt secure and planned to rest in quiet and take time to select a suitable place for headquarters. It happened that William Johnson had sent his son, Warren Johnson, to Tobique, New Brunswick, now known as Andover, to have some grain ground. When young Johnston had unloaded his one-horse sled at Tibbetts Mill, the only mill then in the country, and went up to the tavern to have his horse fed, he overheard conversation which led him to believe that a plan was on foot to kidnap the officers quartered at Fitzherbert's. A mob spirit was in the air. Neighbors a mile distant had got an inkling of the proposition, and soon the little tavern was well filled with men who were willing to stake treats on their ability to capture the Yankee cusses. Someone from the little tavern on the American side had carried the news, and the officers were certainly in danger. The boy watched closely for his grist, and as soon as it was ground, quickly loaded and started toward home with a hope that he could reach Fitzherbert's before the mob got started. His anxiety for the safety of the men made the time spent on the road seem long, so he urged his horse along as fast as possible, but the traveling was hard and his grist heavy. About half the distance was covered when the sound of a team reached him, and he was soon overtaken. During the conviviality at the tavern, someone had missed young Johnston, and a team was hurriedly dispatched to overtake him and not allow him to proceed. The boy was only 15 years old at the time, and there was no alternative, so he surrendered. He was taken back to Tobique and his horse stable, then followed a noisy drinking time at the tavern. Some of the leaders in the kidnapping proposition got too boozy to care what became of the Yankees. Meantime, the heroic boy was apparently tired, stupid, and very indifferent during their carousal. Again he watched his chance, slipped quietly out, quickly harnessed his horse, and succeeded in getting nearly in sight of Fitzherbert's house when his pursuers, who were the least intoxicated with the crowd, overtook him, passed him, and whipping their horses into a run, soon reached the little tavern and secured McIntyre. The others who escaped were loud in their praise of the boy. Warren Johnson, who ever after was a favorite, with not only the main militia, but with a company of regulars sent to aid in the anticipated war. Later, Mr. Johnson exchanged his farm at the Reach, that would be William Johnson, with Benjamin Weeks, whose land comprised a large part of what is now embraced in the limits of Fort Fairfield Village. When a fort was established and the posse had command, Warren Johnson was hired as cook. So well did he fill that position that he was entrusted with cooking the dinner for Governor King on his visit to Aroostook, which of course was considered quite an honor. Young Johnson served for some time with the United States troops as messenger to carry their mails between Fort Fairfield and Houlton, the latter having the nearest post office. He also served in the late Civil War and returned with injuries from which he never recovered. This is a draft call for the Aroostook War.
State of Maine, to Asa Thompson of Searsmont. Sir, agreeable to a regiment order from James W. Webster, Colonel of the 1st Regiment, 2nd Brigade, and 3rd Division of the Militia of Maine, for a draft of 29 men from said town, to hold themselves in readiness to march at a moment's warning. You were drafted, and are hereby notified to arm and equip yourself forthwith as the law directs, for active military duty, and to hold yourself in readiness to march at a moment's warning to the eastern frontier of the state. Searsmont, February 24, 1839. Joseph Mahoney, Oliver Crockett, Select Men of Searsmont. This is an item taken from a Presque Isle paper, The Loyal Sunrise, June 7, 1865. Local sketches. Fort Fairfield. This town, which was letter D in the first range of townships from the east line of the state, lies east of Maysville, north of Easton, corners upon Presque Isle. The village of Fort Fairfield is upon the Rustic River, near the north line of the town, 12 miles northeast from this village, 12 miles east of Caribou Village, and 7 miles from Tobique on the St. John. It is also 6 miles from Little River Mills at the mouth of the Aroostook River. Grand Falls on the St. John is 24 miles north by east from the fort. The village of Fort Fairfield is romantically situated, stretching along for a mile or more upon the bank of the Aroostook River. The citizens of this village are not guilty of the extreme folly of paying exorbitant prices for building lots, for the sake of building their houses and places of business around and upon some corner, thus exposing their property to great risks from fire, largely increasing the rates of insurance, and practically accomplishing nothing except the having of near neighbors. Fort Fairfield was a military post during the Aroostook War. A boom was thrown across the river at this place by the authorities of Maine to detain the lumber cut by trespassers from the province upon the river above. A blockhouse was built near the bank of the river of hewn pine timber, and a stockade fort on the hill at a short distance from the river, intended to protect the boom and prevent its being destroyed by those who claimed the lumber, and also to prevent an invasion from the province. The blockhouse remained until the spring of 1862, when it was taken down and the timber converted into sawed lumber. The officers' quarters and soldiers' barracks at the fort, after the soldiers left, were converted into a dwelling, and was occupied for many years by General Mark Trafton, who was appointed deputy collector and removed hither from Bangor. This building is now occupied for a dwelling. The stockade of the fort has fallen into decay, and in a few years all traces of military glory of Fort Fairfield will have passed away. The fort was named in honor of John Fairfield, who was governor of Maine at the time of the Aroostook War. The town of Fort Fairfield is county. The land is of the best quality, and most of it superior. The people enterprising, industrious, public-spirited, and the tone of morals and religious interest are very commendable. It has two houses of public worship, the Union House and the Friends Meeting House, both of which worship is constantly maintained. Maple Grove is a beautiful neighborhood upon the Center Line Road, which has a post office, a gristmill, sawmill, and many excellent farmers, among them J.W. Haynes, who has a farm and choice stock worth going many miles to see. At the village are four stores with large and varied assortments of goods, one apothecary, one millinery, two blacksmiths, three carriage shops, two shoe shops, one harness shop, one tavern, one lawyer, two physicians, a gristmill, three sawmills, and one carding and clothing mill. The village will naturally have the trade of Plymouth Grant, limestone plantation, a portion of Eaton Grant, and a portion of Easton, besides quite a trade from the province. We regard Fort Fairfield Village as one of the best locations in northern Aroostook, and immigrants will do well to visit that town and vicinity before purchasing. The town contained in 1850, 11 years after its first settlement, a population of 401. In 1860, 914, with a valuation of $80,576. It then had 145 horses, 253 cows, 78 working oxen, 277 head of other cattle, 700 sheep, 127 swine. It raised 1,002 bushels of wheat, 2,100 bushels of rye, 53 bushels of corn, 24,148 bushels of oats, and 2,469 pounds of wool, notwithstanding the drain of men for the war. And Fort Fairfield has done her full part. The wealth and business of that town has largely increased since 1860, and we anticipate the census of 1870 will show a large increase in population and wealth. When the St. Andrews and Canadian Railroad shall be extended, as it undoubtedly will be, along our border towards Canada, Fort Fairfield Village will be the interport of the freight and business of Northern Aroostook, designed for that road. This is an item from a newspaper in 1904. It's the obituary of John Johnston. John Johnston of Fort Fairfield, the first white male child ever born on the Aroostook River, died Saturday, January 21st, after an illness of 2 days. He was born near Presque Isle in June 1822 and was therefore nearing his 83rd year when stopped by death. His father was Charles Johnston, a brother to William, Edward, Daniel, and Nathan Johnston, all Aroostook pioneers who have numerous descendants in this region. His parents both died when he was a mere boy, and he lived considerably with his uncle William. Reaching manhood, he married Miss Virginia Bollier of this town. Mr. Johnston did much teaming all his life and considerably farming, leaving a good farm property at the lower village at his death. He was remarkably quick, strong man physically, whom not one man in many hundred could equal. He was an open, candid, honest, just man who lived an honorable life among his fellows. Though troubled much with rheumatism during a great part of his life, his health was otherwise good till nearly the end. Good. This is a newspaper item in 1936. It's an obituary. Linwood Ralph Seeley, veteran Fort Fairfield Rainsman, dies Friday. About 1 o'clock Friday morning, July 11th, Linwood R. Seeley, one of the best known citizens of Fort Fairfield, was called to his reward. Mr. Seeley was at the races in Presque Isle the afternoon before, having a first-rate time, apparently as well and happy as ever, with no premonition of any calamity. The cause of death was angina. Mr. Seeley was born in Newburgh, Maine, March 29, 1866. He was 70 at the time of his death. A man of very pleasant and social disposition was Mr. Seeley, always having a nice word and cheery smile for everyone. He was a good and thrifty farmer and was all his life very fond of horses. In the buying, selling, training, and driving of these, he was really an expert. He naturally numbered his friends by the hundreds, and they are inevitably filled with grief that one they knew and liked so well should have gone so suddenly from their presence. On earth he enjoyed his friends, also his vocation of training and piloting that noble friend of man, the horse. And a very fine wish for him now would be that his last long journey may far exceed in happiness and splendor anything he had ever known in the way of rides or journeys here on earth. To be a useful man, a kind friend and excellent neighbor were all natural and possible to Mr. Seeley, who certainly succeeded well in all these directions. The loss of such a man, especially with no warning,
cannot be otherwise than deeply regretted by a host of neighbors and friends. Always having a nice word and cheery smile for everyone. He was a good and thrifty farmer and was all his life very fond of horses, in the buying, selling, training, and driving of which he was really an expert. He naturally numbered his friends by the hundred, and they are inevitably filled with grief that one they knew and liked so well should have gone so suddenly from their presence. On earth he enjoyed his friends, also his vocation of training and piloting that noble friend of man, the horse. And a very fine wish for him now would be that his last long journey may far exceed in happiness and splendor anything he had ever known in the way of rides or journeys here on earth. To be a useful man, a kindly man, a kind friend, an excellent neighbor were all natural and possible to Mr. Seeley, who certainly succeeded well in all those directions. The loss of such a man, especially with no warning, cannot be otherwise than deeply regretted by a host of neighbors and friends.